This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
It was one of the most celebrated and perhaps most misunderstood scientific experiments of the late 1980s and early 1990s. It was called Biosphere 2, a closed ecological system located in a gigantic hothouse environment or greenhouse environment in the desert of Arizona. It was called Biosphere 2 because Earth was Biosphere 1, and Biosphere 2 was an attempt to create this closed-loop environment within this structure where the people living there would be able to create their own oxygen, their own water, their own food, with a long-term goal of space colonization. That if people from Earth could live in this closed environment on Earth, they could do it on Mars or indeed on other planets as well. The original idea of Biosphere 2 lasted only a few years, from 1987 to 1991. And although there was a lot of fuss about it when it opened, we haven't really heard too much about it lately. And I got to thinking about Biosphere 2, and I wanted to know what they are up to these days. Well, since 2011, the University of Arizona has been running Biosphere 2. John Adams is Deputy Director of Biosphere 2, and he is our very special guest to explain what is going on there at the moment and what happened there in the past. John, welcome to Overnights.
Rod. Well, it's great to be chatting with you.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. Let's go back to the start of Biosphere 2. It was built between 1987 and 1991. The first biospherians went in 1991. What were the plans when it first began? What was the original idea of what would happen at Biosphere 2?
So that early experiment that began in 1991, really hit the world stage because there was tremendous amounts of publicity. There was coverage of these eight people that were going to seal themselves inside of this remarkable and exceptionally large enclosed environment. It's 1.27 hectares in size. That's, it's a little over 3 acres, almost 3 football fields in length. It has a rainforest, an ocean, a savanna, a marsh, a desert, a separate area, but still adjoined to the main space where they grew their agricultural crops. They had another area that was set aside where they had a kitchen and a dining area. They had their living quarters. They had restrooms. They had analytical labs, workout facilities, a place where they could keep limited number of sort of some traditional farm animals. And that original mission was to see if they could seal this entire environment up, which they did from an engineering perspective, did a remarkable job at doing so. And could those eight people live inside and sustain themselves on everything that they had inside, and only be dependent on energy moving in and out of this system? So the balance of the atmosphere, the production of food, was going to be dependent on everything that was growing within the facility that they had initially started.
How many people went into it?
So 8 people went inside. The recruitment, as I understand it, was not like that of the astronaut program. And I think, we can all read, we can read the different headlines, and there was quite a bit of critiquing of that original group. The premise by which they were conducting the science and how they were going about it. And I think some of it was because there wasn't the same type of rigor that we associate, for example, a lot of these space programs when they go to select astronauts. They didn't have that. But nonetheless, it was a remarkable group of individuals. This entire facility was built in 4 years. We've done experiments here under the guidance of the University of Arizona, and we've remodeled, repurposed some of the spaces. Not trivial, but still not to the extent of building Biosphere 2. And it took us longer to do those than it did for them to build Biosphere. So I think from an engineering achievement, they succeeded. And even from just living inside of a facility, no one had ever done it. We take for granted everything that we see outside. How do you bottle it up and put it inside of a building and expect it to work? I mean, we think about all of the iterations. Well, heck, all the iterations that our iPhones have gone through to get to where they are to this point and to this day, and how they've improved each time. This was the first iteration. They sealed themselves inside. And to think that it was going to go perfectly, I think, is extremely naive. And everything that happened, we've learned a tremendous amount from. And I think, I often get asked the question, well, what's the most important lesson learned from Biosphere 2? In my opinion, that most important lesson is just how little we truly understand Earth systems and how infinitely complex they are. And to think that we could bottle them up and have everything work, I think that's naive on our part.
So how has that original experiment changed since 1991 when the original bias variants went in?
You know, that original group went in and they were inside for 2 years, two full years. Another group went in, this time it was only seven. They were ended up being in for about 6 months. And then there was a significant transition to the Earth and Environmental Sciences. And that's what we're doing today. So there was a recognition by the person who originally financed the project and his management team, as well as some folks at a major university, Columbia University in the city of New York, who really seeded the idea and moved the concept forward of using the facility to understand Earth systems and their responses to global climate change rather than having people live inside. And that's exactly what we're doing today. This is the largest controlled environment where you have complex ecosystems, and you can come in and change the temperature and look at the response of that system, or you can give the rainforest a drought in excess of 70 days and look at what happens. You can warm the ocean up and look at how it impacts the corals and whether these newly developed hybrid corals that are show greater tendencies in the lab, for example, for heat resiliency, you know, do they actually survive when you put them in a complex ecosystem and warm them up? These are all things that we can do at Biosphere at a scale that's unlike a traditional lab, but yet we have the control that you typically don't get when you're working out in the field. We're that middle ground between lab and field.
How did biospherians then and now, for that matter, how do they spend their leisure time? If there's only a small number of people in this confined area, even though, as you say, it's a big area, what did they do? They weren't working 24 hours a day. Do they feel trapped?
No. Yeah, well, they did feel trapped. And so this is personal communications I've had with some of the biospherians. So I'm giving you accounts of those conversations. And they did feel trapped. I think they felt confined, but they also felt a sense of, you know, if you want to call pride and sort of just enjoyment of being inside of the facility. But it was very much a survival mission when they went inside. They had great aspirations of doing a wide range of scientific studies, collecting, monitoring things that were happening inside. But most of their efforts, and almost all of their efforts, were devoted towards agricultural production, and then, you know, producing and actually then harvesting and cooking those pieces of, you know, whether it was grain or onions or wheat or whatever that vegetable may have been, into a meal. And I think we take for granted how long it takes. So one of the bias friends told me a great story and it stuck with me. So she said, you know, we all go out and we want to order a pizza or something from the local restaurant in our neighborhood. So we call up, we place an order, and it's usually at our place by 20 or 30 minutes on average. Now, if you want to cook that same meal, we'll use pizza. You go out to the grocery store, you gather all the ingredients, you come back and you prepare it, and now you've probably invested, you know, maybe 2.5 hours into that time. If you have to grow all of those ingredients from planting the seed to harvesting that particular ingredient, now you're looking at a process just to make a pizza of something that's going to take you 6 to 7 months.
Especially if you want pineapple on it.
Exactly.
So nobody lives in Biosphere 2 at the moment. When were the last full-time biospherians living and working inside Biosphere 2? When did that end?
So that ended back in the mid-90s. And since that time, no one has been living inside. There have been a lot of researchers in and out, but no one for extended periods of time. So very different from the original intent and that which was so widely publicized.
So can it be said then that the original idea of Biosphere 2 was a failure because it was designed to see whether people could live in those conditions and create their own world, all their food, and live independent of Biosphere 1, which was Earth, and that didn't happen?
No, it did happen. It happened for
but
initially
it didn't go
for two
on.
Years. Right. It didn't continue on indefinitely. No, it was not a failure. And I know I hear and read a lot of people who say that that original experiment was a failure because they had to add oxygen in. But again, it was that test run and no one had ever attempted anything of this magnitude and complexities. And so it was, in my opinion, a remarkable success. Sure. Could they have done things differently? Absolutely. We all can look back at different moments in our life and said, well, if we would have done this, this would have been the outcome. You can always do that, especially as you've moved forward in time. But at the time, it was remarkably successful. And sure, they could have done a better job with being more forthcoming with maybe what was happening inside and their media relations. But overall, the experiment was extremely successful. To date, no one has duplicated it, but yet everybody is talking about today, you know, what is it going to take for us to establish a colony on the moon or Mars? And in order to do so, that means that we've got to grow things because it's sort of a common belief that we're not going to solely be able to reside on mechanical devices for our existence. We're going to have to live with people for extended periods of time in a very hostile environment inside of a constructed facility. And, you know, we can see how complicated it is on the International Space Station. And just imagine now putting some type of habitat on the moon or Mars. That is not trivial. But what the Biosphereans did, I think, was a huge first step in leading us down that road that's going to allow us to potentially do that. I mean, they were and are the pioneers, in my opinion, on sort of the closed system, large-scale living spaces. And it's only we're only going to improve on that science and that engineering as we move forward and eventually do put somebody back on the moon and potentially send somebody to the surface of Mars.
John Adams is our guest. He's the Deputy Director of Biosphere 2, which was set up in the early 1990s, then later on taken over by the University of Arizona. So you're saying that what is being done there now is to do with, well, what would happen if we were to attempt to live and work on Mars or on the moon? What were the original ideas for Biosphere 2? And were they successful? You've talked about how it was successful, but what were the original ideas and what did we learn from them?
So the original intent by building Biosphere 2 was really twofold. The one that captured the headlines was this idea of building a precursor to a colony, a test bed for a colony that could potentially be built or established on the moon or Mars. The primary foundation for them building Biosphere 2, though, and again, it's not one that captured the headlines like the previous one, was the idea of just to try to better understand Earth systems. Everything that happens in our lives is in part or completely impacted by the environments in which we live in. And if those environments change, it's going to impact how we live. And if we can't anticipate or adapt, we're not going to survive. And so understanding those systems is critical. And we know that these systems are changing. The availability of resources, the types of resources that come from them. And so Biosphere 2 is a tool that allows us to fine-tune some of the models we're using to predict what may happen in the future. And so it's extremely valuable today, even though we're using it in a slightly different fashion from what was originally intended. Again, this idea of space colonization, but again, at that core, understanding Earth systems.
So it seems to me like these days it's just the world's biggest hothouse, that there are experiments going on there, but people are not living there. So how valuable are those experiments? Because one of the things that people are going to have to learn to do if they are going to live on the moon or Mars is live in that confined environment, and surely Biosphere 2 is the ideal place to do that.
No, you're right. And so it is a large greenhouse. It's not always hot inside. We can cool it down. We can manipulate temperatures. But you're right. We don't have people in the loop, as they say, and that is a critical component. But there are a lot of agencies who are doing studies, have done studies, where they look at the dynamics of humans living in close quarters and reliant on one another, whether it's, you know, various military branches, different space agencies, or even some of these private entities that have looked at the social and psychological dynamics of groups living in close quarters. You know, a lot of those studies have been done. But what a lot of studies haven't been done is looking at how, you know, these systems evolve, develop, and then how these complex systems can be used to inform us as to what may happen in the future. Because now, unlike outside on Earth, we can actually manipulate the water chemistry in our ocean. We can change that temperature, or we can increase or decrease the precipitation inside the rainforest of Biosphere 2 to look at how a drought scenario plays out, and it changes the cycling of carbon, energy, and water within a system. All critical for us to understand if we're going to understand how these, again, these environments that are around us that we're dependent on are going to change. And so that's the value of Biosphere 2 today, is really a scaling tool, but it's also an extremely iconic tool. And so not only do researchers find it extremely valuable, but it's a great tool to captivate, I think, general audiences as to the importance of this type of science.
Can you give us an example of some of the things that have come out of Biosphere 2 that have been implemented in the real world and perhaps changed things for the better?
So some of the things we've learned directly from Biosphere 2 is that, for example, you know, we talk about mitigating factors for increasing atmospheric CO2. We hear a lot about that. And typically we hear about increases in atmospheric CO2 correlated directly to increased air temperature here on Earth. But the other thing that we haven't necessarily taken into account is that, you know, people say that as we continue to pump more CO2 into the atmosphere, the plants are going to continue to absorb it. And to some extent, that's correct. Plants like CO2 and many plants like quite a bit more CO2, and they do better. But there becomes a saturation point, and there was speculation as to how and at what level some of these ecosystems would saturate. And there was a model referred to as the Big Leaf model, where it looked at a tropical vegetation community, and it said it's going to saturate at about 600 parts per million. And we're at about 411 parts per million right now. We likely will reach that 600 value, we'll say, in about 50 years. And at that point, we were able to show in our Biosphere 2 rainforest or confirm that that model was correct. Our system also saturated about 600 parts per million. What that means is it's like you and I consuming food. You know, we can just about eat everything on our plate or a portion of it. We can't oftentimes eat it in its entirety. It becomes a point where we're full. Plants are the same way with CO2. They can take in, but it comes to a point where they can no longer use the additional molecules that potentially are available. And so that is critical if you're looking to try to understand how increases in atmospheric CO2 may accelerate in the future and how that acceleration could impact, the systems we're dependent on. Another one is that, you know, we think about CO2 in the atmosphere, again, in the context that I just referred to, but also it's a gas that's soluble in water. And, you know, everybody in Australia is seeing, and we hear about it worldwide, about the Great Barrier Reef and the bleaching events. Again, a big portion of those is attributed to increases in water temperature, but also a stress on corals is the decrease in the pH of the water, the acidification of that water. And a lot of that is driven directly by increases in atmospheric CO2. And Biosphere 2 was one of the first places to show a direct connection and correlation between increasing atmospheric CO2, which meant that you had more in the water column, which means you had a lower pH for that water, which means that the corals then suffered. So we are one of the first places to see it. And now we see that type of scenario playing out worldwide. And sure, there are things that we can begin to do, but understanding those dynamics is the first step before we can begin to implement meaningful solutions. And I think that's where Biosphere 2 is really that key, is that we can really provide that microscope look into some of these very complex problems and break them down in a way that allows us to really begin to understand them more comprehensively.
You must have had a lot of visitors to Biosphere 2 over the years. Have many politicians turned up to see what you're doing and therefore to make policy because of what you're able to show them?
Unfortunately, no. We've had some. And, you know, we get a number of visitors, you're right, on an annual basis that come through Biosphere 2. And it's incredible how many of them sort of make the same type of reference that you just did, is, you know, why don't more of our politicians come and see firsthand what you all are doing? Because, you know, again, we can speed up, in a sense, time in a way to look at how these changes we predict that are coming our way, we can actually play them out inside Biosphere 2 in a short order and look at what the implications are. And a lot of times, those implications aren't great. They have very dramatic and confounding effects on these systems. And so for that, this is a great tool. And I wish that we could get more of policy type people here so they could see firsthand and hear from our researchers, because it's just amazing. It's equivalent to going out, you know, we hear a lot about, and I keep using, you know, the bleaching events that we hear about on these reefs around the world. We see most very prominently on Australia's Great Barrier Reef, that's a very visual thing. You can see it happening. And I think, you know, that helps to get people motivated to want to do something. Biaser 2 is that visual tool that helps to get people motivated. And you're right, if we can get more people here, I think we can have a more profound impact.
Who can visit Biosphere 2? You know, if scientists do want to have some sort of experiments conducted, do they contact you and say, this is what I'd like to do and I'd like to be part of this? Or can people visit on a daily basis to see what's going on? Who can get to visit Biosphere 2?
You know, that's a great question. And so the answer is that we can do both of those things. Now, people can visit on a daily basis. We have, before all of this pandemic played out, we were open. We've had to limit that for a period of time and temporarily close to visitors. But on a daily basis, we are typically open for visitors. They can come through a significant portion of the facility. But researchers do contact us. Researchers do come in. We just concluded a multi-international experiment where we had people from Austria, Germany, Switzerland, England, who all came to our rainforest and were working in that system. And in this particular scenario, for about 3 months, we had to close the rainforest off to any visitors going in because we didn't want those visitors to negatively impact the research that was ongoing. So we have the capability, and we do periodically flex what is and is not open to be able to, again, accommodate visitors coming in, but also ensure that we're able to carry out the meaningful science that we've been doing here for so many years.
Given that it has changed in its format and that you don't have people living there full time as you did for the first few years of it, why haven't there been other Biospheres 2 or Biosphere 3, 4, 5 built elsewhere in the world, given that it is a significant undertaking, but it's not as comprehensive in the way that you have to have people living there? You could actually just build it in another country.
No, you're right. And there have been attempts. There are, you know, very spectacular botanical garden-like type facilities, but it is not trivial to build an environment like this and then have people live inside and completely isolate it from the outside. It still remains, in my opinion, an engineering marvel. It's a remarkable feat. It is not trivial. And, you know, again, late 80s, early 90s dollars, the estimated cost for construction and getting everything going was right around $250 million. So we use inflation, you know, that puts us probably close to, if not north of, $1 billion today. Unfortunately, I think given the current economic and political climate, it just doesn't lend itself well to people wanting to make that kind of an investment to build such a facility to live inside. But I think we are beginning to see potentially the value in some respects of being able to self-isolate and have everything that you need at your disposal for your survival. What that exactly looks like and plays out, I don't know. But if we're going to go to space, you know, those areas that we're going to occupy need to be typically much, much smaller in size. And so there are teams who are working on new designs that are significantly scaled down versions of Biosphere 2, but still leveraging this idea of bioregenerative life support systems to, in part, balance an internal atmosphere for the survival of humans.
Does it strike you in any way as ironic that we're learning to live in space and we can't actually learn to live on Earth?
It is ironic, but I do think that by us striving to try to live in space is going to only better inform us about our Earth systems. Hopefully, if we're better informed, we have a better ability to deal with changes that are coming our way, and we can be more successful, and it will allow us to understand the implications of some of the things we're doing, hopefully ahead of time, so we can make the necessary changes.
John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And that's John Adams from the University of Arizona. He's Deputy Director of Biosphere 2. And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.